On this March 23rd, this is Washington Today on C-SPAN Radio. I'm Steve Scully. Here are some of your Tuesday headlines. 24 hours after the latest mass shooting, police in Boulder, Colorado have identified the 21-year-old suspect and released the names of his 10 victims. Witnesses say the gunman was wearing a green tactical vest, and by the time he surrendered, he had removed all of his clothing except for his shorts and walked backward towards a SWAT team. Police have recovered an AR-15 assault rifle and a semi-automatic handgun. Among the 10 victims, Eric Talley, one of the first officers to arrive on the scene. He was the father of 7 children. President Biden says he is devastated, suggesting he may use executive action to address gun violence. Also, one day after AstraZeneca announcing its COVID vaccine was shown to be safe and effective in U.S. trials, a federal health agency is casting some doubt on the data that the company used. The CDC is reporting more than a quarter of the U.S. population has received at least one dose of the COVID vaccine. Texas is opening vaccine eligibility to all adults beginning next Monday. And New York City will be ending its work-from-home policy beginning on May 3rd. That will impact as many as 80,000 city employees. Just some of the stories shaping Washington Today ahead here on C-SPAN Radio. We begin in Boulder, Colorado, and reaction to yesterday's shooting rampage that left 10 people dead. It took place less than a week after 8 people were killed in the Atlanta area. Now, a mass shooting is defined as an incident where 4 or more casualties take place, and by that criteria, the killings in Boulder, Colorado, marking the 7th mass shooting in 7 days. The area around the shopping plaza remains a crime scene this evening. And earlier today, in an interview with KCNC-TV, which is the CBS affiliate in Denver, one eyewitness described what he saw and what he heard.
Yeah, my name is Ryan Borowski. I live in Boulder.
Tell me what you were doing and what you experienced inside.
I just went in for a soda and some chips and, kind of changed my directions and heard, one loud bang. I thought somebody just dropped something, an employee or something, and then another. And then by the third one, everybody was running. We ran to the back of the store and, found our way into the employee back of house. Some people were kind of running at the pantry. Employees were telling people, this is the exit. We went out the cargo bay and jumped underneath the loading truck that was there and ran up the back of the hill. And now my car is still here, so that's the only reason I'm hanging out. But, it seemed like it happened at this entrance here on the, I guess, the east side, and I was closer to the west side, so it's just, I can't believe it's happening in Boulder, honestly.
And how many people were around? Was it a pretty busy time here inside the store when this happened?
We weren't tripping over each other, but we were single file, just, somebody had their hand on my back, I had my hand on somebody's back, and we were just saying, go, 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 run. When we got to the back of the store, there were employees who still didn't know what was going on, and we just told them to run.
A firsthand account, that from KCNC-TV, and another witness to the shooting telling CBS Denver that his son-in-law and others were at the pharmacy for a COVID-19 vaccine inside the supermarket. The gunman shot the woman directly in front of him. Now, the Boulder, Colorado police chief, Maris Harold, reading the names of those who lost their lives while simply shopping at the King Super Grocery Store in Boulder.
I'm going to read the names of the deceased. Denny Strong, 20 years old. Nevin Stadinsky, 23. Ricky Odds, 25. Trelona Barkanovyak, 49. Suzanne Fountain, 59. Terry Liker, 51. Officer Eric Talley, 51. Kevin Mahoney, 61. Lynn Murray, 62. Jody Waters, 65. Our hearts go out to all the victims killed during this senseless act of violence. We are committed with state, local, and federal authorities for a thorough investigation, and will bring justice to each of these families. Regarding the suspect, at approximately 2:40 p.m. on Monday, March 22nd, officers were dispatched to King Supers on Table Mesa Drive. Officers arrived on the scene within minutes and immediately entered the store and engaged the suspect. There was an exchange of gunfire, which suspect was shot. No other officers were injured, The suspect was taken into custody at 3:28 p.m. He was transported to the hospital for treatment, now in stable condition. This suspect has been identified as Ahmad Alyssa, 21 of Arvada. He has been charged with 10 counts of murder in the first degree and will be shortly transported to Boulder County Jail. Press release with his identifying information, the victim's information, will be forthcoming. I appreciate you being here. And I want to say to the community, I am so sorry this incident happened. And we are going to do everything in our power to make sure this suspect has a thorough trial and we do a thorough investigation.
That from Chief Harold from the Boulder Police Department. Now, according to the nonprofit research group Gun Violence Archive, there have been 107 mass shootings in this country since the first of the year. The death toll, 122, another 325 injured. Colorado Governor Jared Polis said his heart is breaking over this latest tragedy.
And of course, I'm standing here not just as governor, but as someone who has called this community my home for most of my life and who's shopped at that King Soopers in Table Mesa many times across my life. And, you know, my heart aches today, and I think all of ours does, as Coloradans, as Americans, for this senseless tragedy, the loss of life, as we hear those names, everybody, and Boulder County is a small community. We're all looking over the list. Do we know anybody? I'm sure that we know people that know people. People of all ages, and people who started their day with a cup of coffee and reading the morning paper, or perhaps getting their kids ready and putting on a winter coat to go out. Maybe they were making last-minute spring break plans, but none of them expected that this would be their last day here on the planet. It's a simple run for milk and eggs, you know, getting ready to shop, going in a regular way we all live our lives, something that we can all identify with, led to a complete tragedy here today. And our hearts ache for those who lost their lives, for their families, for the survivors left behind, for the survivors who were able to get out, who have scars that can't be seen but are every bit as painful. And I want to thank the Boulder Police Department, the first responders, so many police from agencies across the state came to the call in the time of need. Not only did we lose 10 lives, but this is real horror and terror for all of us. The simple act of shopping in a grocery store.
Those comments in Boulder, Colorado, from that state's Governor Jared Polis. President Biden is calling on Congress to ban assault weapons and high-capacity magazines, as well as to close the loopholes in those background check systems after the shootings in Colorado. He's also ordered flags at half-staff to pay tribute to the 10 lives lost. His remarks from the state dining room at the White House.
There's still a great deal we don't know about the killer and the motivation of the killer in Boulder, Colorado, and other critical aspects of this mass shooting. I've been briefed this morning by the Attorney General of the United States, the Director of the FBI. I've spoken with the Governor, and I'll be speaking with the Mayor on the aircraft. We're working very closely with the state and local law enforcement officials, and they're going to keep me updated as they learn more. You're going to ask me to speculate. Understandably, you'd ask me to speculate about what happened, why it happened. And I'm not going to do that now because we don't have all the information, not until I have all the facts. But I do know this. As president, I'm going to use all the resources at my disposal to keep the American people safe. As I said, at this moment, a great deal remains unknown. But three things are certain. First, 10 lives have been lost and more families have been shattered by gun violence in the state of Colorado. And Jill and I are devastated, and the feeling, I just can't imagine how the families are feeling, the victims whose futures were stolen from them, from their families, from their loved ones, who now have to struggle to go on and try to make sense of what's happened. Less than a week after the horrific murders of 8 people and the assault on the AAPI community in Georgia, While the flag was still flying half-staff for the tragedy, another American city has been scarred by gun violence and resulting trauma. And a state that I even hate to say it because we're saying it so often, my heart goes out. Our hearts go out for the survivors, who had to flee for their lives and who hid, terrified, unsure if they would ever see their families again, their friends again. The consequences of all this are deeper than I suspect we know. By that, I mean the mental consequences, the feeling of, anyway, just been through too many of these. The second point I want to make is my deepest thanks to the heroic police and other first responders who acted so quickly to address the situation and keep the members of their community safe. And to state the obvious, I commend the exceptional bravery of Officer Eric Talley, and I send my deepest condolences to his family, his close, close family and 7 children.
As mentioned, Eric Talley, one of the police officers killed. He was 51 years old. Now, during his remarks, the president called on the Senate to pass 2 House-passed bills that would expand background checks for firearm sales. One bill would close the so-called Charleston loophole by extending the initial background check to a review period from 3 days to 10 days. That bill, by the way, is linked to the 2015 shooting in Charleston, South Carolina, in which a white supremacist killed 9 black Americans at the Mother Emanuel AME Church. More from the White House.
We can close the loopholes in our background check system, including the Charleston loophole. That's one of the best tools we have right now to prevent gun violence. The Senate should immediately pass, let me say it again, the United States Senate, I hope some are listening, should immediately pass the 2 House-passed bills that close loopholes in the background check system. These are bills that receive votes of both Republicans and Democrats in the House. This is not and should not be a partisan issue. This is an American issue. It will save lives, American lives. And we have to act. We should also ban assault weapons in the process.
That from the president earlier today. And on the politics of gun legislation, we'll be talking to Savannah Berman of USA Today in just a few minutes. While the president was delivering those remarks, the Senate Judiciary Committee holding a pre-scheduled hearing on gun violence, of course, one day after this latest mass shooting. Illinois Democrat Dick Durbin is the committee's chairman.
We can't keep up with it. I can't change and amend my opening statement to keep up with it. It just keeps coming at us. We are numb to the numbers. Unless we are personally touched, it's just another statistic. That has got to stop. This committee, this hearing, I hope will open a conversation about constitutional, common sense ways to reduce gun violence in America. We see the problem we're up against as a public health crisis. So what should we do about it? We won't solve this crisis with just prosecutions after funerals. We need prevention before shooting. If there's one thing which we should have learned from the COVID-19 pandemic, it's that we face a public health crisis. When we face one, we can reduce the toll of harm with common sense, science-based solution. We should set goals to reduce the number of deaths and shootings, collect and study the data, identify the cause and risk factors, and apply prevention and intervention strategies that makes the numbers come down. We can do this. The fact that guns are lawful products with legitimate uses must not stop us from taking action to reduce gun deaths.
And those comments from Senator Dick Durbin, the chair of the Senate Judiciary Committee. It was at the hearing that Texas Republican Senator Ted Cruz accusing his Democratic colleagues of using this latest tragedy to try to take guns away from law-abiding citizens. Here's what happened.
The Department of Justice has a long and, I think, indefensible practice of not prosecuting felons and fugitives who try to illegally buy guns. If Grassley Cruz had passed, the Gun Crimes Task Force that it had created would have charged prosecutors with going after gun criminals, locking them up, and putting them in prison. That's how we prevent these. Now, we will learn in the coming days and weeks the exact motivation of the murderers in Atlanta and Boulder, Colorado. We'll learn what happened there. But we already know this pattern is predictable over and over and over again. There are steps we can take to stop these crimes. And you know what the steps aren't? The steps aren't disarming law-abiding citizens. Every year, firearms are used in a defensive capacity to defend women, children, families, roughly 1 million times a year in the United States. And the Democrats who want to take away the guns from those potential victims would create more victims of crimes, not less. I agree it's a time for actions. And by the way, I don't apologize for thoughts or prayers. I will lift up in prayer people who are hurting, and I believe in the power of prayer. And the contempt of Democrats for prayers is an odd sociological thing. But I also agree thoughts and prayers alone are not enough. We need action. Today, Chairman Grassley and I are introducing again Grassley Cruz, and I would ask Senate Democrats, including some of our newer colleagues who just got here, not to participate again in the shameful filibuster that this body engaged in 2013. Let's target the bad guys, the felons, the fugitives, those with mental disease. Let's put them in jail. Let's stop them from getting guns. Let's not scapegoat innocent law-abiding citizens, and let's not target their constitutional rights.
Senator Cruz is a member of the Senate Judiciary Committee. Earlier today, it was during a Q&A with reporters on Capitol Hill that another Republican senator, John Kennedy of Louisiana, commented on the shooting and America's Second Amendment rights.
America is a big, wide, open, free country. We're probably the freest country on earth. And freedom is risk. When we decide to give everybody freedoms, we know that not everybody is going to exercise those freedoms responsibly. I'm not trying to equate the two exactly, but a lot of Americans drive cars. Some drive cars drunk. And they kill people, and that's horrible. The answer to that is not to get rid of all sober drivers. Certainly these killings, any killing, whether by a gun or another weapon, is horrible. But what some of my Democratic colleagues want to do is to basically get rid of the right to keep and bear arms to stop the killings. And that's like stopping all people from driving because some drive drunk. And I think that's what underpins this debate. Not all. I don't want to paint with too broad a brush. But many of the people promoting greater gun control, if you really drill down and probe what they truly believe, they don't believe in the Second Amendment. They don't believe that Americans should have the right to keep and bear arms. And what they're trying to do with their gun control legislation, in many cases, not in all cases, is to basically undermine the Second Amendment.
Louisiana Republican Senator John Kennedy made his comments earlier today on Capitol Hill. And joining us on the phone is Savannah Berman, congressional reporter for USA Today. Based on what we saw yesterday in Boulder, Colorado, that horrific shooting, will that in any way move the needle with Congress?
I don't think that these shootings in particular are going to be able to move the needle just because all Democrats would need 10 Republicans to join them in order to pass the filibuster on the two gun control bills that passed the House. And Senator Joe Manchin, a Democrat from West Virginia, came out today and said that as they stand now, he would not vote for either pieces of legislation. So it's looking like both of these bills are really facing a steep incline in the Senate.
How significant were those comments by Senator Manchin?
They're very significant. I mean, the Senate is split 50-50. It was already going to be a challenge for Democrats to get 10 Republicans to join them. And if they're losing people on their side of the aisle, it's very unlikely that these bills, as they stand, would pass the Senate and make it to President Joe Biden's desk to become law.
As you point out in your story, which is available at usatoday.com, Democrats calling this a public health crisis. But we heard earlier in the program the comments from Senator Ted Cruz at the Senate Judiciary Committee. Why is that getting so much attention today?
Well, I mean, Senator Ted Cruz called the hearing ridiculous theater and really touted alternative bills to the two pieces of legislation the House put through. Senator Dick Durbin, the chairman of the Judiciary Committee, opened the hearing by calling the gun violence in the United States a public health crisis. So from those two comments, you can really see how both sides of the aisle are viewing the issue right now. Democrats called for action, specifically want to pass the legislation that would expand background checks for firearm purchases, and some are even going as far as calling for banning assault rifles. But Republicans are wanting to take a completely different approach to this. They're saying that expanding background checks would not have played a role in preventing these shootings and are going to instead infringe on Second Amendment rights. So both sides of the aisle, political parties here, are just on completely different wavelengths. They agree that something needs to be done, but that's really where the agreements stop between the two sides.
Savannah Berman, she covers Congress for USA Today. Thank you for being with us.
Thank you.
Meanwhile, at a time where many Americans, many Asian Americans, are facing discrimination and attacks, especially after the shootings last week in Atlanta, Senator Mitch McConnell commenting on what we're seeing in this country. We should point out that he is married to Elaine Chao, whose family is from Taipei, before they emigrated to the U.S.
Gun violence and mass shootings that we've seen over the years, do you personally regret the opposition that you had to expanding background checks, including the Manchin-Toomey bill that the Republicans brought in 2013?
Yeah, well, with regard to the bill that is going to be up in the House that the president, I gather, supports, I joined Joe Manchin in opposing that bill. With regard to these acts of violence, they are absolutely horrendous. Let me focus for a minute on the shootings in Georgia. As the husband for almost three decades of an Asian American woman, I have noticed and we have experienced over the years racial prejudice against Asian Americans. It certainly rose to the fore for everyone else when we saw these shootings. These despicable acts of violence should need to be condemned for what they are, but the legislative solutions have been perplexing, and as I said, I share Joe Manchin's opposition to the version that passed in the House.
A story we'll continue to follow on the C-SPAN network, so those comments from Senator Mitch McConnell earlier today on Capitol Hill. And you're listening to Washington Today. And welcome back to Washington Today for this Tuesday. Here are some of your other headlines. The cherry blossom season is here in our nation's capital, but crowds along the Tidal Basin will be strictly limited. In fact, the National Park Service says the area will be shut down if the crowds get out of control. And in neighboring Virginia, Governor Ralph Northam announcing that the state will begin easing restrictions for concerts, restaurants, as well as for upcoming family gatherings as the graduation season gets underway. And there is more news on the economy and COVID-19. Regal Cinemas will open in April for the first time in 6 months after the company's theaters were shut down amid the pandemic. Cineworld Group, which is the parent company of Regal, announcing what it's calling phased reopenings starting next Friday, April the 2nd, with a limited number of the company's theaters opening. Regal has more than 500 theaters coast to coast. The phased-in reopening will begin at 25 and at 50% capacity. The AstraZeneca vaccine has not yet been authorized by the U.S., but yesterday the company announced promising data in a press release, saying its vaccine had a 79% efficacy rate and was 100% effective in preventing severe disease and hospitalization. But some of the data may have been incomplete. We'll get some details just ahead, but during an appearance on ABC's Good Morning America, Dr. Anthony Fauci reacting to this development.
You just heard this morning that major concern that AstraZeneca may have included outdated information in its trial results. How did that happen? And what could this mean about its possible effectiveness?
Well, what happened, Robin, is that the data that are analyzed from any given trial go through what's called the Data and Safety Monitoring Board, which is an independent group of people who are experienced and who look at the data. when the data from the AZ trial that was conducted predominantly in the United States was analyzed by the DSMB together with the company, what happened is that the company put out a press release giving data and making some conclusions about the efficacy. And the Data and Safety Monitoring Board, when they saw that press release, they got concerned and wrote a rather harsh note to them and with a copy to me saying that, in fact, they felt that the data that was in the press release were somewhat outdated and might, in fact, be misleading a bit, and wanted them to straighten it out. On the basis of that, we put out the release that you just showed that essentially told the company they better get back with the DSMB and make sure the correct data get put into a press release.
And that development earlier today, Dr. Fauci, the full interview available at abcnews.com. And for more on the story, we spoke late this afternoon with Cecilia Smith-Schoenwalder. She covers COVID-19 for U.S. News and World Report.
So what we've got here is a pretty uncommon statement coming out from the National Institute of Allergy and Infectious Diseases. It comes less than 24 hours after AstraZeneca announced its interim analysis of its vaccine. That showed a 79% efficacy in preventing symptomatic disease. It also showed a 100% effective against stopping severe disease and hospitalizations, which, by the way, was a higher efficacy than we thought we'd get from this vaccine. So we don't know right now what aspect of the data that the Data and Safety Monitoring Board is questioning. It's possible the interim analysis did not include more recent data that could change those numbers. But all they've said right now is that they have concerns that the trial's data could have been outdated. And so we might have an incomplete view of the efficacy data.
So where does that leave the vaccine and its pending approval by the FDA?
We'll note that the AstraZeneca has not yet applied for an emergency use authorization from the FDA. Company officials have said that that step could happen in the first half of April. I'd think that these questions are going to be answered in the upcoming days. So it's hard to say if it will affect the timeline of an EUA, but we can be pretty sure that the development will be talked about during that review process.
And so when Dr. Anthony Fauci says that this was, quote, an unforced error by the company, where does that leave AstraZeneca?
Right. Well, it's sort of the latest blunder for this company, right? So AstraZeneca's vaccine, it struggled to gain public trust from early on. It showed a lower efficacy rate than some of its rival vaccines in earlier trials. It also lacked data on older populations, and that led to questioning whether it should be used in people 65 years and older. More recently, the vaccine faced concerns over blood clots, which forced the European Medicine Agency to issue a review that found the vaccine to be safe and effective. Still, the regulator said that a link between rare types of blood clots and the vaccine cannot definitely be ruled out. And that's not all. You might remember that in its U.S. trial, it faced close to a two-month pause after a possible illness in a participant. So when you take a step back and you look at all these developments, it kind of paints a worrisome picture because it could lead to increased vaccine hesitancy in a crucial point of the pandemic.
We are talking to Cecilia Smith-Schoenwalder. So in terms of the Americans hoping to still get a vaccine, so far 25% of Americans have had at least one vaccine. We have Moderna, Pfizer, and Johnson & Johnson. When could we see AstraZeneca, potentially?
We might see AstraZeneca apply for an EUA in the, before the mid of April. Maybe it would be approved later in April, maybe even in early May. Let's just say that the vaccine starts rolling out in late April or even early May. That's a point in time that President Joe Biden has said that there will be enough vaccine supply for every adult in the U.S. So it's left some experts suggesting that the U.S. might not really need as much of this vaccine anyway, and maybe it actually should be donated to other countries that do need it more.
The full story at usnews.com. Cecilia Smith-Schoenwalder, we thank you for being with us.
Thanks for having me, Steve.
Meanwhile, the president in Columbus, Ohio, happening right now, a portion of his remarks.
Look, I want everybody to be aware that there are three key parts of the American Rescue Plan all my colleagues supported here. First, we're going to more rapidly acquire, we set out to more rapidly acquire enough vaccine to vaccinate every single American quicker than anticipated. And what my COVID team and went through, and we used the Defense Production Act, we've been able to organize and help increase the number of doses in a much shorter time. So by the end of May, we're going to have on hand roughly 600 million doses, enough for every American. And the American Rescue Plan is also going to provide funding for more vaccination sites, vaccinators, and the paraphernalia needed to put that vaccine in one's arm. In addition, there is a second important piece of that plan. It's focused on dealing with the economic deprivation so many Americans have become subject to a consequence of this virus through no fault of their own. Millions have lost their jobs and are still out of work. Around 11 million children in America are going hungry through no fault of their own. But as a result of the pandemic and the economic crisis, millions of Americans are not able to maintain their mortgage payments or rental payments and have found themselves on the verge of being evicted and having their homes repossessed. Well, we stepped in and we prevented that from happening with the American Rescue Plan. Hundreds of thousands of businesses are now not going to go under, but they're going to have an opportunity to reopen and have the financial assistance to be able to do it the right way and safely. Schools closed and children losing up to a year or more in learning capacity. You're ahead of the skates here in Ohio, but across the nation, the help was badly needed, and we've now provided the funding for that. Because of isolation and violence against women is up, abuse of children is up, and the need for mental health problems to deal with mental health problems and the consequence of them is up as a consequence of COVID. And in addition to that, suicides are up. Second, the American Rescue Plan brings relief to a population that's badly hurting. And one more element of our response is that first and foremost is a commitment to get Americans $1,400 check per person, including per child. So a firefighter and a school teacher making $120,000 combined with two kids are going to get a direct payment of $5,600 in cash. If they already have an account online with the IRS, which many do, by tomorrow we will have distributed 100 million of those checks.
That update from the president in Columbus, Ohio, we should point out, wearing a face covering. And related to all of that, this story at WashingtonPost.com, the headline, the Fed chair and the Treasury secretary's message to Congress. The story reads in part, quote, a year into the coronavirus pandemic, after the loss of millions of jobs and the closure of thousands of small businesses, the Federal Reserve and the Treasury Department have a message for Congress. It could have been worse, and there's still a long way to go. Testifying before the House Financial Services Committee today, the Federal Reserve Chair Jerome Powell and the Treasury Secretary Janet Yellen telling lawmakers that the economy is slated for booming growth this year, but their sunny forecast was paired with reminders that at least 9.5 million jobs are still missing from the labor force and that fully healing the economy will depend on getting the pandemic under control. The full story at WashingtonPost.com. It was during today's hearing this exchange between the ranking Republican member of the House Financial Services Committee, North Carolina Congressman Patrick McHenry, and the Treasury Secretary Janet Yellen.
Final question I have is about oversight, Secretary Yellen. Your predecessor agreed to very onerous and rigid and strong oversight for the CARES Act. And this current $1.9 trillion has rescinded all those things, sadly, except this quarterly hearing. And so what I'd like to hear is your voluntary commitment to work with Congress, the GAO, the Special Inspector Generals, and the Congressional Oversight Commission, as well as this committee.
Well, you have it. I think oversight is very important, and I pledge to work with this committee and the oversight groups.
And that from today's House Financial Services Committee and those brief comments by the Treasury Secretary. One additional note from today's Washington Post story, this quote, many Republican lawmakers, Wall Street investors and economists are worried that the economy will not be able to absorb a massive stimulus package and a post-pandemic consumer spending that would push prices rapidly upward. Their worry is that dangerous cycles of inflation will force the Fed to hike interest rates, triggering potentially a new recession. At the closing bell on Wall Street, the Dow losing 308 points. The Nasdaq was down almost 150. The S&P off by 30. And the New York Times is reporting that President Biden's economic advisors are pulling together a sweeping $3 trillion package to boost the economy, reduce carbon emissions, and narrow economic inequality, beginning with a giant infrastructure plan that may be financed in part through tax increases on corporations and wealthy Americans. After months of internal debate, writes the New York Times, the president's advisors are expected to present the spending proposals to the president and to congressional leaders this week and into next week as they begin to outreach to industry and labor groups. The story at nytimes.com. And there is another money story brewing on Capitol Hill, the issue of congressional earmarks. TheHill.com reporting that Senate Republicans remain split on whether to embrace them or reject their return, which would be attached to spending items to key pieces of legislation. For that story, we talked to Jordan Carney, who was on Capitol Hill earlier today.
So we have a situation, I guess, in Congress right now where you've had Democrats say they are going to bring back earmarks, which allow lawmakers to sort of direct money towards specific projects back in their home states or their home districts. And sort of a surprising decision, we had House Republicans lift their ban last week on earmarks, and now Senate Republicans are sort of the odd person out and are trying to figure out if they are going to follow suit amid some pretty strong feelings in their caucus.
Is there a sense that by resuming this practice, it in a way could create more bipartisanship because Republicans would have a stake at some of the legislation being passed and where the money is being spent in their own districts or state?
Yeah, I think that's the hope, is that, you know, if you resume earmarks, it could maybe lessen some of the gridlock that we've seen in Congress recently, in hopes that, you know, maybe this is a way to get Republican buy-in for pieces of, you know, Biden's agenda or the government funding bills that they're going to have to do later this year, and just sort of create a dialogue.
In your piece, you quote the chair of the Senate Appropriations Committee, Pat Leahy of Vermont, saying that he's willing to have what he calls designated spending. So can you explain, define what that is?
So under sort of the guardrails that are being discussed, a member would have to sort of publicly disclose what the money they're requesting would be going towards. So, you know, making designated spending back for a specific project or a specific, like, nonprofit, maybe back in their home states, since it's the Senate. If it's a House, obviously it's a home district. But there is a lot of pushback to this idea of resuming earmarks among particularly sort of the fiscal hawks or the conservatives in the Senate Republican caucus. So they have not really made a decision yet on what they're going to do.
One of those, Senator Ted Cruz, who you quote calling the return of earmarks is, quote, a serious mistake. But what about other Senate Republicans, including Senator Richard Shelby of Alabama, who is stepping down at the end of next year, but he is the top Republican on the Appropriations Committee, and Senator Susan Collins of Maine, who was just reelected?
Yeah, I mean, there's definitely a different group, particularly among, I mean, the two people that you just mentioned, sort of the Republican appropriators, that this, you know, being able to direct where this money goes is a prerogative of Congress. And if they don't do this, they're just going to be giving, you know, that decision-making power away to the executive. And I was talking to Senator Thune, who sort of, you know, mentioned the division within the caucus, but pointed out that if Democrats are going to go forward with earmarks anyways, and Republicans don't join them, that they're basically just saying, you know, missing out on the possibility of directing money back to their home states.
We're talking with Jordan Carney of The Hill newspaper and TheHill.com. In terms of the timeline, of course, the recess is coming up next week. So when will Senate Republicans and Democrats sit down to take up the issue?
You know, Leahy was asked that question, and he sort of tied it to when they start moving the government funding bills might be sort of when things come to a head. So, you know, late spring, early summer, or I guess if, you know, past this prologue and they delay midsummer or late summer as we get sort of closer and closer to the September 30th deadline to fund the government. But he sort of pointed towards that as maybe something that takes this to the next step. And then there's been some discussion that maybe Senate Republicans as a caucus need to have a meeting and figure out what they're going to do, because they did vote to include in their caucus rules back in 2019 a permanent ban on earmarks.
The headline, Senate Republicans torn over the issue of earmarks at thehill.com. Jordan Carney, thank you for being with us.
Thanks for having me on.
And a reminder, this program, it's available as a podcast. Remember to sign up so you never miss an episode. You can also follow us on Twitter at C-SPAN Radio. I'm Steve Scully for the Tuesday edition of Washington Today, hoping you enjoy the rest of your evening.